Greetings and welcome to our show, A Nuclear World. The first part is a three-part series of presentations of current information on the nuclear industry. It is the intention of these presentations to explore many aspects of our nuclear industry phenomena, its impact on our health and environment, and the part we as individuals play in all of this. It is also the intention of this program to search further to discover the deeper roots and meanings behind the occurrence of this present-day phenomena some have referred to as nuclear madness. Today, we will interview Dr. Ernest Sternglass on the physiological impacts of the nuclear industry on our health and environment. Dr. Ernest Sternglass, Professor Emeritus since 1967, is retired but still a member of the Faculty of Radionics Physics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine in the Department of Radiology, where he has been doing research in the field of radiation and its effects on humans, as well as instrumentation in radiology and nuclear medicine. Prior to that, Dr. Sternglass was senior physicist at Westinghouse Research Laboratories in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he worked in the field of nuclear medicine, radiology, and radiological instrumentation. He is the author of two books, Low-Level Radiation, published in 1971 by Ballantine Books, and Secret Fallout, published in 1981 by McGraw-Hill, and has made contributions to the writing of Deadly Seek by Jay Gould and Benjamin Gouldman, just published by Four Walls and Eight Windows, which is currently available at bookstores. Dr. Ernest Sternglass has testified before numerous federal agencies and state government bodies on the subject of radiation fallout from nuclear accidents and releases. He has published over 120 papers and review articles in the field of different subjects relating to instrumentation, nuclear physics, nuclear medicine, and the health effects of radiation. Before we begin this interview, I would like to invite everyone to listen to the information Dr. Sternglass will present to us with an open mind. It may be tempting to point the finger and pass the blame for the problems that the nuclear industry is seemingly creating for us. I would like to invite everyone to join in an experiment in expanding our vision and to look at this issue also as perhaps a metaphor for the occurrences and interactions we create and experience in our daily lives. It is the consciousness of them and us, the belief that separation can exist, that largely contributed to, if not created, this nuclear pollution phenomena in the first place. Those thoughts and beliefs led us to feel in turn that we needed to have deadly weapons and power-generating sources of astounding capacities in order to live in this world. From that perspective, the nuclear industry could be a result of our mass consciousness or our lack of it. I sense that the nuclear industry is not the core problem. It is merely a symptom of it. Perhaps the information we will be listening to is a reflection of the darkness that exists within each one of us as it is outwardly manifested in our world on a mass level. It is the desire of this program to have light, light being knowledge and wisdom, to shine on that darkness, darkness being ignorance and fear, so that we can review this phenomena more clearly and then be guided and directed into realizations that will facilitate our own self-healing of our sociological illness called the nuclear industry. And now, here's Dr. Ernest Sternglass.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. And, of course, it's really a wonderful time to be here because we're seeing the beginning of the end of many of the problems of the nuclear age as far as hopefully weapons is concerned. but we still have enormous problems with nuclear reactors and, of course, the existing huge stockpile of weapons that could still be used in some accidental war.
I'd like to start on a broader base and then focus in on more specialized information. For example, what exactly is radiation?
Well, you know, radiation is like light coming from a light bulb, except that in the case of the damaging radiation like X-rays and gamma rays we're talking about, the wavelength is much shorter. It's invisible. It's sort of like the ultraviolet light, except more so. X-rays are the most familiar form of radiation that we have. They penetrate waves that actually penetrate through most tissue. As you know, you can have an X-ray taken, and that was discovered about almost 100 years ago.
Okay, that leads me to my next question. I have heard different people say that radiation is a natural occurring phenomena, and that, for example, the sun is a form of radiation, and therefore we should not be concerned about nuclear radiation because it is just another form of this, and as the sun is not harmful, a lot of the radioactivity generated from nuclear industry is not. Now, I know that there's a lot of different things that are being touched upon in what I said. However, I'd like to ask you to clarify some of this for us.
Well, of course, the sun emits a lot of radiation, and the only reason why we haven't been totally destroyed by it is that we're protected by our atmosphere, which absorbs most of it. Certainly the ultraviolet radiation is, a lot of it is absorbed in the upper atmosphere by the ozone and doesn't penetrate to the ground, or else life could not have formed on Earth without a protective atmosphere.
So this is then the main function of the ozone layer itself, to filter out those harmful radiation rays from the sun which would otherwise be destructive to us.
That's right, in terms of the ultraviolet. But some cosmic radiation gets all the way through the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Fast so-called mesons, unstable particles and other particles that are created in the atmosphere by bombardment from outer space go right through us, and they make up about a third of the radiation we get.
I see. Okay, thank you. Do you know what part the radioactivity generated from the nuclear industry plays on the destruction of the ozone layer, and if it is destructive, how so?
Well, that's very interesting that you ask. Most people think it's these compounds made from fluorine in our refrigerators that are mainly destroying the ozone layer.
Or aerosol cans, they say.
Yes, the aerosol cans. But actually, the most destructive of them all are radioactive gases. And during the time of the nuclear bomb testing, there have been a series of studies done by our own National Academy and many other scientists that have shown that during the time of nuclear bomb testing, there was a serious destruction in the ozone layer, about 3 to 5%. And I'm afraid that there was a very serious destruction of the ozone layer on the mainly on the South Pole in 1987. And this was just about a year to a year and a half after Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. And only in the last few months in Nature, an article was published that showed that radioactivity from Chernobyl was detected on the South Pole, on the snow and the ice, that was transported through the stratosphere and got down into the South Polar region, where presumably the magnetic fields of the Earth concentrated the charged particles so that they actually helped to destroy the ozone layer. And so the fluorine compounds are not the only problem. The continuous emission of radioactive gases from the manufacture of plutonium, the dissolution of the uranium rods in the reactor, lead to the emission of a lot of gases that destroy the ozone layer, as well as the daily emissions from our nuclear reactors.
That was another point that I wanted to bring out. Nuclear power plants have in their design a reoccurring release of radioactive gas that they cannot function without it, so that a properly, perfectly functioning nuclear power plant is constantly releasing radioactive gas.
Yes, most people didn't know this, and I have to admit that until 1970, I myself, even though I worked in the field of, you know, X-rays and radiation and nuclear instrumentation for years, did not know that government regulations allow large quantities of radioactive gases to be discharged from normally operating nuclear power plants on a routine basis. Otherwise, they could not operate.
Mm-hmm. That brings me now to the question about x-rays that we receive from the dentist and from our doctors. Since more and more evidence is being brought forth, even in the New York Times most recently, concerning a reevaluation of the effects of low-level radiation and radioactivity on health and the environment, even not including all of the wonderful research that you've done, I'm wondering, how does that change our perspective on the safety of radiation through x-rays from medical treatment?
That's a very interesting point. Actually, and this is really a tragic situation in a way, the lack of serious effects of chest x-rays and dental mm-hmm. x-rays, the lack of seeing them very obviously, did fail to warn us about the seriousness of the radioactive particles emitted from nuclear fallout, from bombs, mm-hmm. and from nuclear reactors on a daily basis. We underestimated the effect of all these new chemicals that are created in the fission process by about a factor of 1,000 times compared to a medical x-ray. So the interesting thing is that there have not been very serious effects of ordinary diagnostic chest x-rays and ordinary x-rays, and that led us to believe that emitting strontium-90 and iodine-131, which mm-hmm. are only created by the fission of uranium or plutonium and get into the environment, that those elements are not harmful either. And that mm-hmm. was a terribly great mistake.
I see. So then can we still continue to feel relatively safe by having these medical x-rays, or have you found in your research any evidence that shows perhaps over a period of 10 to 40 years, cumulative or long-range effects can develop from these?
There are undoubtedly some side effects of x-rays, no question about it, because we've seen it most dramatically in the case of the newly developing baby. Mm-hmm. Dr. Alice Stewart at Oxford University discovered this about 1956-58, mm-hmm. quite by accident. She was looking, actually, thinking that benzene and chemicals in the household might have mm-hmm. caused an increase in leukemia in England, but her study showed very quickly that the greatest increase in the risk of cancer and leukemia among children was due to diagnostic x-rays during pregnancy. And that was totally unknown for the beginning of the nuclear age until about 1958. And then nobody wanted to believe her.
I'd like now for you to speak to us about the research that you've been doing and what you feel most strongly about presenting to us in terms of what's happening now.
Well, I would say the most important conclusion is really that we vastly underestimated the small daily releases from nuclear plants that sit in farm and dairy areas like Lancaster, New York, and upstate New York around Nine Mile Point near Lake Ontario. Those places emit continuously radioactive iodine in the milk and gets into the grass, and the cows eat the grass, and then the milk gets shipped a few hundred miles right into New York City. And in the case of Lancaster, some of it reaches New York. Most of it goes to Baltimore and Washington, D.C., so that the inner city, the poorest, often the minorities, blacks, Hispanic, the poorest segment of our society has been exposed to continuous radiation as if a small amount of nuclear bomb testing had continued all these years. And that has led to the birth of underweight babies. We've been able to show that wherever there were large increases in fallout, there was a sudden increase in the number of babies born under 5.5 pounds, 3-4 pound babies, and that is the most tragic thing for our society, and it's the most difficult to accept, because we've looked forward to nuclear plants as a clean way of generating electricity without coal, you know, without anything that we can see in the environment. But the tragic danger is that what we have done is to slowly poison the weakest members of our population so that the newborn babies have enormous problems. They are born underweight with brain damage and things like that. And that's, to me, the greatest threat that the existing nuclear reactors still produce for us.
Okay. That brings up three questions immediately to me. One is, how is it determined that the dairy products and the milk was sent to those areas as opposed to other areas, and who determined this?
Well, we discovered this quite by accident when I've been recently working with Dr. Jay Gould and Benjamin Goldman on the preparation of a new book called Deadly Deceit, just published by Four Walls, Eight Windows. When I was working with them, we discovered that there was data available from the Department of Agriculture that showed where the milk goes from each county in the eastern United States, covered by the milk marketing agreements. And we found that places like New Jersey, they took the milk from around their nuclear plants at Oyster Creek, at Salem, and sent it out of the state. And the same thing happened in Virginia. Around their nuclear reactor, they sent it out of the state. And the same thing's happening in Pennsylvania. More than half the milk from around Three Mile Island ends up in New York City. So what has happened is that the people have been aware of the problem of rising infant mortality, of leukemia and other things, and they thought that, well, the way to make sure that, you know, it's not discovered is by diluting it and sending it to the large cities. Because if you had left it in the immediate area and the local people had all been consuming it in New Jersey, then, of course, New Jersey and the places around the plant would have shown the greatest increases in leukemia and cancer and things like that, and also in, you know, underweight babies. And this way, because we placed the nuclear plants far from the cities, and in those areas, very often, there's, you know, many cows grazing, and like Lancaster, the biggest farm dairy area in the nation, and it gets into the milk of the people in Washington, D.C. And we saw, as shown in this book, that only after those plants started to operate was there a tremendous rise in infant mortality among the black minorities in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. and New York City.
Okay. That brings me to the second question, which is, how could that perhaps be related to the high rise in cases of AIDS among minorities?
Well, I'm afraid it is very closely related, because we've recently been studying, and again brought out in this book by Dr. Gould and Ben Goldman, that AIDS, the number of registered diagnosed AIDS cases in the United States rose very sharply in the fall of 1986, within a few months after Chernobyl. After the Chernobyl fallout reached us in the United States. And now we've discovered the same thing in Switzerland. An enormous increase in the rate of rise of AIDS in Switzerland within a few months after the fallout from Chernobyl was deposited on the beautiful snow-peaked mountains and poisoned the water and the food and the milk in Switzerland.
I see. And how would this be also the case with cancer?
Exactly. In fact, AIDS and cancer are very closely related. We know that many AIDS patients develop cancers later in life, and some of them rather quickly, in a matter of only a year or two after being diagnosed. And the tragedy is that the immune system is damaged by the radiation, and that means that the individual has trouble fighting both infections and cancer cells. Lymphomas and other cancers, Kaposi sarcoma and other, all these cancer cells can be fought by the immune system. In fact, in a recent issue of the Scientific American, it was shown that by aiding the normal immune defenses of the human body, you can actually cause cancers to regress, and it's a new form of treatment. So it's clear that if we can treat people by improving their immune system and actually make cancers disappear, we can also accelerate cancers by destroying the immune system. And that's one of the most serious things that radiation does, affecting the immune system both in the thymus, in the case of the baby, the thymus gland sitting in the neck right near the thyroid, and the bone marrow, where the white cells originate and which all of us have to constantly produce anew in order to keep producing a police force in the body that protects us from the aggressive cancer cells.
So then it may be safe to say that the real cure for, and the ultimate cure for AIDS and cancer, isn't even necessarily strengthening the immune system, but going a step further and stopping the nuclear industry or the production, let me say, of radioactivity generated through man-made industry.
Well, it's not going to end cancer completely because there are natural sources of radiation around, like the sun and the rocks containing radium and so on.
Right.
But strontium-90, which particularly, and strontium-89, both are created only in the fission process, and they go to the bone marrow. And iodine-131, which is very short-lived iodine that only lasts for a week but does very great damage because it's very active, goes to the thyroid of the developing baby and lowers its immune system because it irradiates the nearby thymus gland and also destroys much of the hormone that control growth and normal development, including the brain function and the body size and the normal development of the immune system. So it's extremely important to end all radioactive releases into the environment, including underground tests, which, despite what the governments have been saying, constantly have accidents and leak into the environment, which blows all over the United States, and particularly for the people in Nevada, Utah, California, and all those states near the Nevada test site, like Arizona, New Mexico, and so on.
I've also heard that there's some research that's being done now that correlates the underground nuclear testing with earthquakes.
I've seen this article. While I was in Russia just now attending an international conference on underground nuclear testing and trying to bring it to an end, I was given an article by a Canadian scientist who has shown an enormous correlation between the number of large killer earthquakes, like the one we just had in Iran and in Armenia.
Yes.
And those earthquakes have doubled to tripled in number since 1945, since the first atomic bomb was detonated. We keep forgetting that even a bomb detonated above the ground shakes the earth, literally shakes the earth, and that many small bombs have been detonated. Most people don't know this, but we have detonated about the equivalent of 40,000 Hiroshima bombs, both above ground and underground, since the day of the first atomic bomb. And this has had an enormous effect on our environment, on our food, on the air, on the ozone layer, even things like acid rain and things like that, that people just have never been told.
When you were in Russia, did you present the material that you have?
Yes, indeed. I gave a lecture, I gave a talk, a presentation about our latest findings, which show that in Russia, the same increase in infant mortality took place that we saw in the United States during the period of their own bomb tests, especially in the early 60s when the Chinese also began, and the fallout from China drifted into Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, all the regions of the mountains near Tibet where they were doing their bomb testing in Kazakhstan, and that greatly aggravated the economic problems, the health problems of the Soviet Union. And interestingly enough, I found that those regions of the Russian Republic, Soviet Republics, that were downwind from their test site in Kazakhstan, in the mountains where the snow brings down the fallout, those areas like Turkestan, especially Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, the mountains region, those had the greatest increases in infant mortality, whereas the more distant regions like the Ukraine kept going down, although at a lesser rate.
Who specifically did you give your presentation to, and how was it received by them?
Well, this was given before a group of physicians from all over the world. There were 22 nations represented, gathered by the International Physicians Against Nuclear War. Both the Russian and the American groups came together, and there were 450 people from Soviet Union and behind the Iron Curtain, and 300 people from 22 countries around the world, and all of us, you know, brought out all the different aspects of the continuation of underground testing and its great danger, and that we must bring it to an end.
And did they respond favorably to you?
Yes, as a matter of fact, this was really amazing to me. I had two offers from two different Russian journals that they wanted my presentation, and they were going to translate it into Russian and publish it in Russia.
Oh, that's wonderful.
For the first time, the Russian government has begun to publicize the true effects of radiation.
That's wonderful. You have another book called Secret Fallout, which was published...
Yes, it was published in 1981 by McGraw-Hill. And that was the second of my books. The earlier book was called Low-Level Radiation, and it was published by Ballantyne, but it disappeared from the market very quickly, I'm afraid. That was back in 1971, 72, and I'm afraid what happened, as I found out to my amazement, is that out of the 50,000 books that were printed, within 6 months, 25,000 had been sold, and then when people tried to get copies of the book and kept calling me why they couldn't get any more, and I checked and I knew that only, you know, some 25,000 had been sold, I found that the 25,000 had been burned, that the publisher had been bought up by RCA, and that Ballantyne's books were cleaned of the most serious books that dealt with the environment, including mine. One book on mercury pollution, another book you know, on how to fight polluters, they were taken off the list by the newly acquired publisher, and they actually destroyed, without telling me and without giving me a chance to purchase, the remaining 25,000 copies of my book. Now I'm afraid all my books are out of print.
Why do you believe this happened? Did they tell you why?
Nobody ever told us, but I imagine that RCA at the time was competing for the anti-ballistic missile contracts, for the electronics, for the ABM system back in 1969-70, which I attacked in my book and showed that the use of an anti-ballistic missile system would create so much fallout that even if it were to stop all the incoming bombs, it would poison the stratosphere and the atmosphere and the environment so that, you know, most of the newborn would die before they ever reach reproductive age. That was published in Esquire magazine as well as in many scientific papers that I gave. And that was, you know, deadly for the military who were trying at the time to promote the anti-ballistic missile system. So I imagine it was a concerted effort on the part of the military to get rid of books that threatened the continued development of these advanced anti-ballistic missile systems.
I see. And then you say that you rewrote this information in another book?
Yes, and I updated it to include the effect of Three Mile Island, which, by the way, has been vastly understated, and as a matter of fact is shown in Dr. Gould's new book, Deadly Deceit, that there were perhaps 50 to 100,000 people who died of all types of diseases within a year or two after Three Mile Island in the immediate area up to 500 miles away. And so I included my earlier findings on Three Mile Island back in 1980-81, right after the accident in 1979, showing how infant mortality had increased. And that book is now out of print. I could not get McGraw-Hill to reprint it.
When was that originally published, the second book?
The second book came out in 1981, and within a couple of years it was out of print. And people kept writing to me, why can't you get it? You know, and so I called the publisher and asked them to, you know, why wouldn't they reprint it? And they said, well, this is a type of book they no longer want to, you know, publicize.
I see.
You mustn't forget that McGraw-Hill also is the publisher of many of the biggest textbooks in nuclear engineering and also the publisher of Nucleonics Week, many of the journals and newsletters of the nuclear industry. So I suppose after that book had appeared, they received a lot of pressure because I showed how the, you know, the results of nuclear accidents have been vastly understated by our government in order to keep the nuclear industry alive.
Do you have any of this information in abbreviated form in papers?
Oh, yes. I have a series of papers and short articles, scientific, and written some of them for the layman. Appeared as recently as 1986 and 1988 that I'm able to provide people, and if they want, they can find a way to write to you and obtain the information.
Okay, we'll present those papers and how you may be able to get them at the end of this interview. Is there anything in particular now that you'd like to talk about that perhaps I haven't asked you yet?
Well, obviously, we've got an enormous subject here that one could talk for days about. Mm-hmm. But I think the most important thing that really people need to understand is, number one, that we can do something about the most terrible problems that our society has, namely young babies being born underweight, which then leads to babies not being able to work well in school because they have subtle brain damage. Most people don't know that strontium 90 and strontium 89 has been found in scientific study to change the immune system of a woman, which is a very important thing during pregnancy, because if the immune system is not quite fully functioning, a mother will reject the fetus as a foreign body, just like a foreign organ. In a transplant, like a heart transplant, is often rejected by the body's own immune defenses. And therefore, what we didn't understand back in the 1960s and 50s and 60s when the bomb testing was done, or in the 70s when we built these giant reactors, is that strontium 90 and strontium 89 that is discharged routinely from every reactor and from every underground bomb test and from every nuclear detonation in the world, that this causes babies to be born underweight. And that has been found by all the gynecologists, obstetricians, and pediatricians to be the biggest single cause of infant death and the biggest single cause of retardation, of learning problems, dyslexia, and all types of seizures, brain damage, which then leads to the children not being able to perform well in school. And that starts a terrible chain in our society. It means that the children cannot function well. They drop out. They often commit suicide because they fail in school for no reason. Despite all the efforts of teachers and parents and school, the kids can't function. Often their thyroids are also damaged. That means they are lethargic. They don't know why, but they can't pay attention. It's not their fault. We are doing the biological damage that then creates dropouts. It creates juvenile delinquency. The children become violent. They hate the ones who succeed, and they see no future for themselves. Many young girls drop out and become pregnant because they have nothing else in the world to look forward to. They want a little baby. So it enhances all the problems that we have in our society. And the poorer you are, the worse your diet is, the greater is the effect of damage to the thyroid and the immune system, you see. So we have a whole chain of events that we have triggered by not understanding the full impact of all this radioactivity on the immune system.
That brings up a number of questions, one being, would that also attribute to a lot of miscarriages which seem to be occurring nowadays? Some people say it's because women have been getting pregnant later on. However, perhaps that's not really what's causing it.
Well, as a matter of fact, you bring out a very important point. During the time of Chernobyl, in the month of July, June, July, August, after the Chernobyl fallout arrived in the United States, in places like Massachusetts, where the milk was very heavily contaminated coming down from Vermont into Boston, it turns out that there was an enormous number of miscarriages and spontaneous abortions, spontaneous early, you know, death of the unborn, stillbirth. And that during the months of June, July, it was down 80-90% down. Only a few babies were born during that summer. And in places like Poland, that we have talked to Russian physicians and Polish physicians about, they said that there was, you know, a fantastic drop of babies born live because so many babies were miscarried. And by the way, the same thing happened during the 50s, when many women in the United States had trouble carrying babies to full term. and they were given estrogen, they were given hormones, and as you know, that in turn had very often serious problems for their children, for their daughters especially, later on in life.
DES was one of the drugs at that time administered to
counteract. And so we didn't realize that the bomb testing was causing so many miscarriages.
The thing that I find ironic is that many physicians will recommend drinking lots of milk and eating lots of dairy products to pregnant women, when in fact this could be causing a lot of problems.
As a matter of fact, this is a real tragedy. There was a study done here at Columbia University in the 60s in which they wanted to supplement the food of the poor in Harlem by giving them extra cheese and milk and the kind of thing they normally were not buying. And after a few years of studying, they found that the women who had gotten the extra help by being given more milk, more cheese, more what looked like wonderful food, turned out to have increasing problems with prematurity. But nobody understood it at the time. They just stopped the project and stopped supplementing and stopped doing that research. Ironically, we're still doing it to our poor, and the poor don't know it. They're getting cheese and milk, which the government bought up often from around the Wisconsin nuclear plants and the ones near Lancaster, where the surplus in milk gets converted to cheese, and then this cheese bought up by the government is given to the poor as supplement to their diet.
I'm wondering, how would this also affect the occurrence of drug addiction in our youth?
Well, as a matter of fact, this is a very interesting and important problem. Only recently, there were a number of articles published, reviewed in the New York Times recently, in which it was shown that drug addiction appears to be, to a large degree, related to brain damage, to the improper function of the chemicals needed for the neurons to fire that carry out all the functions of the brain. And as a result of those kinds of early damage during development, there are certain chemicals that are missing, natural morphine-like substances, so that an addict, a person who tastes, who tries one of these morphine-like substances, or you know, cocaine, finds that it makes him feel good because he was lacking these normal chemicals in the brain, and therefore is an enormous enhancement to addiction. Normally, people who are given drugs simply because, say, they have cancer or they have a serious burns or need to fight pain, they don't become addicted. The average normal person does not become addicted to painkillers and to morphine and things like that.
Do you have any idea what the correlation in terms of statistical amounts is between the development of cancer and the development of problems birth-related and child development-related as a result of radiation fallout and testing?
Well, the two are really related, except one appears first and the other appears later. The immediate effects are that children are born prematurely and have all kinds of physical and mental and emotional problems, learning problems. But then the risk of developing leukemia peaks about 5 to 7 years later. And then after that, it diminishes. And fortunately for children above about 10 or 15, the risk is very, very low again. It's reduced to a very low value. So that we have a direct, pattern. First, you see the babies miscarried. Then you see the babies die in the first year of your life. Then you have the developmental problems. And then 5, 6 years later, you get the cancers. And that's what we're going to see after Chernobyl now. The same pattern is developing in Russia. At first, there were huge numbers of miscarriages. And now the latest studies show big increases in leukemia, 10, 20-fold in some areas, even as many as a few hundred miles away.
So it is safe to say then that this sharp rise in childhood cancer could be directly attributed to radioactivity through the nuclear industry.
Absolutely. Dr. Alice Stewart now concludes that 70 to 80% of all our childhood leukemias and cancer are due to the so-called harmless radiation in the normal environment and as contaminated by man. So that what we can do is to eliminate any further sources of radiation in the environment, and we will greatly reduce further the number of cancer and leukemia cases. And in fact, this is also evident and discussed in detail in Deadly Deceit by Dr. Gould and Goldman, which is a book that everyone should read because it not only talks about the enormous damage we've done during the time of nuclear bomb testing because we were so ignorant of the great sensitivity of the fetus and the young infant, but we also failed to know how the government, when it began to realize that it was doing, having much greater effect than expected, that the government began to cover up the data. They literally falsified the radiation data around Savannah River when they had an accident there, as discovered in Glenn's committee. And they falsified the radioactivity measurements of short-lived isotopes like strontium-89 and iodine-131, which disappear in a matter of weeks or months. They literally falsified the readings in the milk by reporting them as negative, which is physically impossible. And we discovered this quite accidentally.
So then we could even say that a large part of the money that is being given to cancer and AIDS research for treatments of the disease might actually be better spent in shutting down the sources of these diseases to begin with, which are nuclear power plant and weapon production, and then developing alternative energy generating sources and intensive conservation plans.
Absolutely.
Of energy.
Absolutely. There's no question that the greatest and most beneficial investment that we could have is to phase out nuclear reactors because it is impossible to enforce a thousandfold reduction in the emissions. They were just not designed for that. And we know that one study after another now, especially in Russia now and Chernobyl and all over Europe, they found in Hungary, in Turkey, in Germany, in northern Italy, an increase in infant mortality and an increase in the number of babies born underweight, thousands of miles away from Chernobyl. The same thing in the United States. We found it directly all through the United States between May and August of 1986, when the Chernobyl fallout had arrived and poisoned our milk, in direct relation to the amount of iodine measured by the EPA in the milk during that time, there was a reduction in the number of babies born and an increase in the number of infant death and total death among adults, especially older ones. Perhaps 40,000 or so died in the summer of 86 above normal expectations, just adults alone, and another 30,000 or so baby were miscarried.
What did you find about Chernobyl and what's occurring there now in your visit to USSR?
Well, it's just very recently that a study appeared in Germany in their American, in their equivalent of the American Medical Association. The German Medical Association published Dmitry Grudzinski and Dr. Edmund Langenfelder published an article in May of just recently, in May of 1990, in which they give the first details on how vast the damage was, not just to humans, but to plants that grew enormously out of proportions, trees that died hundreds of miles away, that animals miscarried 25% of all the little piglets born in, you know, these areas all around Chernobyl were misshaped and misformed. Cows went blind. Calves were born unable to walk. All the things that we saw around Three Mile Island that our government tried to discredit and say, oh, that's, you know, totally meaningless. All these things were now greatly happening in the Ukraine and in White Russia, which is quite a distance away, and it has had devastating effects in the economy. Not only were people evacuated now, 200,000 to 300,000, but they're talking in this article about another 100,000 that are going to have to be removed because it's impossible to grow anything without having them being further contaminated for generations. So it was an incredible disaster that now has affected millions. And in fact, this article, and I think even Time magazine, reported that the overall cost of this one accident, this one industrial accident, was probably going to amount to $300 billion by the year 2000. So what's happened is an enormous increase in infectious diseases, throat infections, infections of virus type, bacterial type infection because the immune system was damaged. And that's for people hundreds and thousands of miles away, not just within a 10-mile evacuation zone. I mean, that is the most ridiculous concept of all, that by evacuating people from around 10 miles, you can save many people. The greatest damage was done in Krakow, 400 or 500 miles in Poland away, in Switzerland, and in southern Germany and Bavaria, infant mortality rose. I mean, there is no way to protect us against another accident, and it can be so devastating, it can destroy an entire nation.